Well, man, following... How do I sound, okay? Following Richard Brodigan is going to be too much. He's a time bomb. It comes on easy and blows you up. Well, it's a good thing Rich read first, or maybe Rich should have read last, because where he's happy, I'm sad, and where he's glad, I'm mad, you know, so... So I guess you might say I'm a... A good contrast to Rich. Well, this will be the first time I've read in a long time, and I'm going to read all new stuff. I'm going to read the first chapter from my new novel. It's a short 9-page chapter. And I'm going to read 3 poems, all brand new poems, poems that I just wrote in the last month. So the name of my second novel is called Gin for Christmas. And it's about, the title comes from a record that Lionel Hampton, the old jazz great, made in 1947. And when I heard the record, it's one of those hot jazz babies that just bam, 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 is tremendously arranged. So, and yet everybody really bursts free within it. It's really great. It's something like Lemon Drop. Probably nobody's heard a Lemon Drop yet. Well, this is the kind of jazz piece it is, and it really wails. And so when I started writing this thing, I had these guys in a bar, see, and I wanted to put somebody down who'd be on the jukebox at that time. So I put Tommy Dorsey, Benny Goodman. It just didn't suit the thing. And then all of a sudden, bam, it hit me, Lionel Hampton's Gin for Christmas. And this novel is about a young boxer who becomes a bunco man. I don't know if everybody knows what a bunco man is. A bunco man is a con man who talks you out of your money. And these guys used to, and when I was 17 years old, I used to hang around this bar called the Naughty Pine, which I call a paradise in the story, and I was a bunco man. And we used to wait by the Greyhound bus depot for the servicemen who got discharged from Japan and would get discharged with their bonus money to go to the Greyhound to catch the bus. And then I'd go pick them up because I had the baby face. And then we'd take him downtown, and we'd play a little game with him called a strap. It's a woman's garter and a toothpick. And they'd have to pick the right hole in the middle to make the garter catch when it got to the end. If they didn't, they lost all their bonus money. Do you see? So that's the kind of a place it was, and it was Gin for Christmas. Okay. It's about a guy who becomes who's a boxer, loses the Golden Gloves tournament, and then in order to make it with his big brother, who is a professional fighter and looks like he might become a champion, he becomes a bunco man, a thief, so his brother will admire him since he's lost these gloves. See, the young cat has got this dual hang-up. All of us have two primary drives in us. One is the will to survive, and the other is the will to procreate. And one is the saintly side, of course, the will to procreate. Which is love, and the other is the killer instinct. And we all have these in us. This boy has them in extreme amounts each side. So he digs his chick. She doesn't want him to fight, so he loses the gloves, and this is the kind of story it is. He ends up dying because of this split in his nature. In a good sense, it's autobiographical, and in another sense, it's not at all. So the first one, the first chapter is called Burial, because it all starts with this burial, the whole story does. Each tear is a crystal heart. I count them. 1, 5. Paper spots, damp. Blurring print. Streaking my thoughts. But I'll spread them for you. Give the why. Why? Because I ache in my gut. Because my intestines cramp with memory. And the memory is greased with blood and brains. And this is the why of that. I am a coward in a cane, some kind of Judas, a merchant sailor whose chapped lips pucker up like a betrayer's kiss, whether I like it or not, when the turbine churn doesn't drown the memory of the fight sounds, the whacks of the sawed-off bat on his back, his breastbone, or his cries. But I'm your brother, brother. And then I have to try it again, try to ride it away again, or I'll start battling the guys on board, battling before I hit that beach again, where at least I get drunk first and then fight. And I'm in my early 30s, but my hair is gray, and my brows are scarred from beer bottles and billy clubs and big fists, and my knuckles are almost double-boned from punch breaks. And on every trip, I swear I'll never do it again. None of it. Yet I keep on battling, and battling because I wish I'd been his brother, Francis's brother, and because I wish I'd been Ernie's brother, and Augie's brother too, but Francis most of all, because I wish I'd been his brother. Say, Francis, let me sing you a song. Let me pull a piece of the sky down and stir it with my tongue, whip it into a froth with blood and words, sign paint it all over the city, on billboards and bank granite, toilet paper and newsprint, headline it, headline it. Make them hear me, motherfucker. Yeah, Francis, I remember. It was Christmas Eve at the Paradise Club, and the joint was packed. Couples jitterbugged all over the floor, kicked it up to the hot beat, fast jazz. For the band was blasting out Gin for Christmas for about the 10th requested time, and Johnny Apollo was hitting his trumpet so hard that the blue whirl of his horn seemed to vibrate the crystal stars on the blue velvet ceiling and even ripple the juice of my highball glass when in came Francis, a little black-haired dude in a blue suit, with his brows up and worried, who saw me looking and slammed the door with a muffled crush, pushed past the jitterbugging couple, then stepped quick as a sailor across the slick floor to keep from sliding, came straight to us, and said when he got there, "Say, could I see you, Ernie? I'd like to speak to you," and wouldn't look at none of the rest of us. But I saw his face good up close, and he could have been crying even, for there was a dark tinge to his lid rims. Yet Ernie's bullet-shaped brow burned a sullen blue in the bar light, and his thick upper lip was all shadow and stayed closed, and all of the rest of us felt attention too, for blonde Sheila sat as fragile and still as crystal next to him, and Al T, who was usually one of the biggest loudmouths, seemed as quiet and sightless as a blind man behind his horn-rimmed shades. And I was mighty silent myself, looking down on Francis from my bar stool even. I was so big at 6'3", 205, only 19, and strong enough to throw a sailor at a street pole. But the knot in my belly was cramped with resentment at Ernie. Tough guys usually get a tough shit when they snivel. And he wasn't coming on as no big hero to me. Not this time. Seemed to be passing the buck to his little brother Francis, is all I thought. And so did little Augie, who was drunk already, it looked like, with the kinky hairballs on his chest showing under his unbuttoned gaucho, and his eyes about the color of the scotch glass, mist and all, because Augie made a funnel out of one side of his mouth for a talk hole and said, "Don't kiss his ass, Francis. What kind of a punk are you anyway?" And Ernie spun around like to blast Augie for butting in, and Curly's fight manager, the owner of the Paradise, came on fast with some manager talk to keep him from killing the little guy, though his tweezer-tipped mustache was twitching with disgust at Augie, who opened his mouth to say something else, but got shut up by Francis himself, who said, "Mind your own business, Augie." Augie smiled sort of tautly then and looked away. But Ernie was so surprised and pleased at Francis for putting his favorite down over him that he sat up and leaned his back against the bar and asked, "Talk about what?" But when Francis said, "Why, I," he said, "I know why," and stopped him. Yet his own voice was short breath, as if it was hard for him to talk too, because he had messed up himself, and he knew it. It could have been this or that. Francis saw him who goofed, and Francis said, "I mean about them being cops, Ernie." But Ernie said, "I know about that too." "Ask Press," Francis said. "He'll tell you." "I already know about that," I said. "I tried to warn you, Ernie." "And I know all about that too," Ernie said. And Happy St. Cyr drummed it all out with his drum, took it away with a thump, thump, thumping, pop, pop, popping melody and percussive phrase, which got everybody in the place on the edge of his seat by the time he'd roll on up to the bing, bang, bang of the bass drum and the cymbal crash. Then out of its ringing echo, like a tin hum in the center of my ear, the trumpet rose in an anguished cry, a lyrical mom was sailed up over our heads and stayed there for seconds at a time, sounding so pretty and so sad, yet so glad to be alive on this Christmas Eve. And that's how it all started. And that's where it all ended, too. I can still see all of the scenes of that last bar fight, though I don't want to, and though they're all mixed up in my head yet. Some of them shoot on past like a film tableau, and others blur and wave all over like a negative, which makes me that much more confused. I still don't really know what happened or what it all means, and there must be some meaning to it. There must be. And who's guilty? And how much? That's what tortures me the most, forces me to search my memory to find out, forces me to face all the unpleasant facts, especially those from just before the fight, when we had a bunco team, me and Francis and Ernie, to beat the discharged servicemen coming home from Pacific out of their bonus money. And the facts about our boxing team, too, to win the golden gloves, in which Francis was the fighter and Ernie was the manager and I was the trainer. And then I start wondering how much Sheila had to do with it, her and her trying to make a high-rolling pimp out of Francis, and Francis's cute little chick Lorraine, too. She was a slender, dark-haired little broad who could have had a lot to do with his trouble because she didn't like him boxing at all, and he was really hung up on her for a long while. But I have to go even further back than that to find out, as far back as the World War II years, to those furlough days for Ernie when Francis and me were kids, around the time their mother died. I forced myself to spin out those years, searching a shallow memory, blurred by booze and billy clubs, a head concussion from a bat whack, and finally sink back into those warm June days during the war and see Ernie the day he came home from Texas on an emergency furlough because his mother was dying. I can see him step out of a cab in front of the big brown Victorian house with a sunshine sheen on his summer tans across the broad spread of his shoulders, his cap brim glimmering like a halo across his brow, a suitcase in one hand, handsome as a movie hero and the real Golden Gloves champion of two states, with a rugged thickening to his facial features and a small break knot on his strong bridge bone. But his square jaw sinks instinctively down toward his thick chest for protection from persistent training, and his small eyes are a serious brown and seem to be squinting over more than the bright sunlight, and his leg stretch is short and hesitant, and he stops only a couple of steps from the cab, near the curb, and he stands there until the cab hums away in first gear, leaving a blue cloud of exhaust, the burnt smell of carbon dioxide, which envelops him in his hazy ways for a few moments, and now blurs my memory. But another one comes into focus instead, a dark one, one from the night I spent with Francis later that week and woke up in the middle of it at the sound of worried voices and the whining of Rebecca, who was close to crying over her mother in the hospital. Her voice carried down the upstairs hall to me on the same floor, then broke off, and I heard Ernie say, "Francis prayed when she had that attack. It was the best thing to do." Murmurs of his father and sister then in agreement, and I glanced at Francis to see if he heard it. There was a faint glow to his features even in the dark, and his closed lids and full cheeks were heavy with sleep, peaceful as an altar boy's, which he was, and he didn't wake up much later that night either when I heard the hall phone ring and footsteps pad down the hall stairs. The ringing stopped, Rebecca cry out, the phone slammed down, and her footsteps pound back up the stairs. Then there were more footsteps. A door creaked. A crack of hall light showed under our bedroom door. Many people seemed to be moving around. I could hear them downstairs too, but in foot slides and whispers, which went into the front hall and went down the front stairs. Then I heard car doors and the whinny of a starter, the whine of it dying, the whinny again, then an engine cough and kick over, get gunned once, twice, three times, nervously, impatiently, and then coughing once or twice more, grind off and down the street, pop-popping out of hearing, and I fell asleep. I forgot all about that phone call the next day until the afternoon when I saw Francis's fat old man hang a purple wreath on the big front door like it must have been done in the cow towns he came from long ago. But the fancy floral edges suited the worn Victorian house, run down some from when its original owners had it, but still pretty grand-looking inside and out, and the leaded windows on the oaken door gave the wreath a hallowed touch in turn, like in a church, and a priest could have stepped out past the door any second with his altar vestments on, and it wouldn't have surprised me. Saw about 50 people come out that very night for sure to go to the funeral home to see Laura, the mother, and pray for her soul. I went with them, but waited at the bottom of the stairs with Francis before we left. And man, he sure looked sad. His fat little cheeks looked full as a baby's and made him seem younger than he was, and he was small enough for 12 already. But on top of this, he seemed to be all eyebrows slanting down and about ready to cry. And I thought that though I was sort of a sissy who followed him around, and though I was 2 years older and a foot taller at 14. His old man didn't look in too good a shape either. He was so shook up over his wife that he started telling what people to get into what car without letting them just sort of do it themselves and maybe only find a ride for some of the strays who needed it. He didn't have no tact as it was, and he stood there with his belly pushing out of his suit coat and his hat on the back of his bald head, his frowning face jerking this way and that, calling out a name and pointing with his big hand at a car for the person to get in it, keeping this up until he got to Rachel, Francis's cousin, a frog-eyed broad, who didn't like it and same as said so, the way she puffed up her sallow cheeks, pursed her pale lips, pulled her black old woman's coat around her pulpy body, which made her look like the nun she was soon going to be, and wouldn't budge. And everybody was embarrassed until Ernie stepped up with his big front teeth winking and asked her if she'd like to ride with him, and took her arm when she nodded and opened the door of his 40 Studebaker for her. There must have been 100 people in the room of the funeral home, which stunk of gardenias, and all of them were cramped down on their knees in front of the fold-up metal chairs, chanting prayers, coming in as a chorus after Rachel's "Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee," which came out as a shrill-pitched sound, close to a scream from my place, and which rang in a dry, echoing note of itself for the split second before the chorus came in, which echoed for a moment itself before she came in on it with her shrill voice again. And then they came in on her dry echo again. And pretty soon the chorus reverberations and her dry voice began to ring together and kept ringing together, seeming to swamp the room in chanting wave upon chanting wave of hot breath and shrill cry and gardenia stink until nausea gripped me, and I was sure that I'd throw up unless I got out of there right away. But I never got to, because Francis stood up first in the front row, where he'd been kneeling in the carpeted step below the coffin. He weaved back and forth above the heads of the kneelers for a moment, with his hands clasped, his lips still working, then suddenly stuck out his arms and lurched across the altar toward the open coffin, fell on its lip with his hands inside, his shoulders hunched, and only the back of his head showing, sobbing, "Mother, mother, 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 mother." And we all got to our feet just about that time that Ernie reached him and started prying his fingers loose from his mother's clasped hands, but gently. His own eyes wrinkled up with his own pain and got Francis to let go, then turned him around and let him out past me, Francis's mouth an ugly crease with spittle on it, and Rebecca tottered on her high heels, and the old man began to cry in a hoarse voice, "And I'd like to stop right now, but I can't." The steel-gray coffin was closed for the funeral mass, and it lay dead as a block of lead upon the altar under stained glass windows without a flicker of light upon it. Yet when the pallbearers carried it by me out to the hearse, I spotted a single fold of white silk lining pinched out by the closed lid, and it stays in my memory still, a single fold of silk next to the steel gray of that coffin, sticking out of there like it's not supposed to, for forever and ever. Saw Francis next out on the sidewalk with his eyes puffy from too much crying, watching him put the coffin into the hearse, then stepping to the black limousine to get in and go to the graveyard. But he stopped before he got in and turned around and stared at the pedestrians on the street corner who had stopped to stare at him at the funeral, and he seemed surprised to suddenly see that he was on public display, and he blushed and ducked his head and got right into the car. There were a lot of cars in that line on the way to the graveyard for only a housewife who came out to California only 4 years before. It was as if all the people from Colorado came out to see her and to say what a one in a million she was. There must have been 100 cars, and they straggled out behind the hearse for blocks and even kept coming for 5 minutes or so after the hearse got to the cemetery. But they got there, and it was a sunny day in the country with sprinkles of different colored flowers all over the green lawns between the headstones. We all stood packed together with the black hole in the middle. Buzz of a priest's voice. Coils of sunlight on the long curls of Francis's little sister, Belle, who was watching her mother go down below. Some crying, and the old man's fat belly would jerk with a quiet sob every once in a while. But though Ernie looked unhappy too, he kept his arm around Francis throughout the whole ceremony, with his thumb resting against Francis's neck, below his ear, until they walked away. And that day when I saw Ernie come out of the big house by himself, stand in the shadow of the porch for a while, look up and down the street as if to make sure that no one was around, and push up his cap and sit down on the top step and stare at his feet, and I couldn't tell if he was crying or not until he looked up at the sound of the front door behind him, and his face was all twisted and tearful. It was Francis who came out for him, who blocked out the wreath on the door with his own face until he reached Ernie. It was Francis who put his hand on his big brother's shoulder, leaned down to see his face better, and sat down beside him to console him. And that's the way I've always remembered them, together, until Ernie went to war and Francis went blind. That's the first chapter of the novel, and I hope I haven't made everybody feel too sad now. I wish I could be Richard Brautigan, because he's happy, man. I mean, everybody feels so happy around him, you know? Then I start reading my poems, man, and everybody gets sad and get bum kicked. Okay, this one has, this one is a little bit like Richard's poem. I'm going to read three poems, and that's it. This one's, what time is it? Oh, it's 2 o'clock. Who's got a split? If you got a split, go ahead and split. Okay. This is called Carol. This chick was a hippie chick that I used to have. And she was really bright, and she was really a gifted chick. And, you know, like they're not supposed to have sex hang-ups. The hippies ain't supposed to have sex hang-ups. Bullshit, man. This broad was hung up from the beginning to the end, man. And she did everything not to be hung up, to be free. And she was hung up everywhere she turned, you know? And that's the reason we didn't make it, because she was hung up. Okay, she's looking for that ultimate transcendence, and she ain't transcended this yet, you see? I have some good news, though. She's been in France for a year, and now she's writing poems like hell. So, you know, she's committed, it seems. Okay, this is called Carol. Let me tell you about a chick I had. Her name was Carol, and she was a tall broad about 19, with blonde hair that hung down to the very curve of her ass, and shined, man, like yellow piss off a tenement roof in the noon sun. No kidding. And she had a pair of sad eyes, too, that drooped way down to my heart, where the still blood on the bottom part, gelled cold from my last love, shimmered a little. But she had a crooked face, and her mouth, man, had some kind of stubborn edge to it, like the set of the teeth beneath, purse the pink lips, but not quite tight together to form a pocket in the center which bubbled around with sweet air, which she sucked through like a dove's coo or let out like a moan if she got hot. but she couldn't come, no matter what she tried. And though she'd force me to crush her in my arms till her backbone cracked, or run my tongue down it, vertebrae by vertebrae, to the tail end, and she gasped, or she wouldn't give, she couldn't come. She couldn't come, though she joined the flower girls in daisy chains with broads and buddies and flower buds that bloomed no bigger than her belly button, had petals paler than the cheeks of her ass, blue as the sky in her eyes and red as her blood. She couldn't come, though she crossed her heart 10 times over with psychedelic beads and wore finger bells on her little toes and soft leather boots that laced clear up to her loins. She couldn't come, though the pot smoke spread in red blinking signals through her eyes. She couldn't come, though she shot speed till she blacked out in the middle of a kiss, standing up. She couldn't come, though she hit the sack with other guys, one at a time, once too often for me, I said, as she stood by the door with a lowered head and her back against the wall and her hair looped around her neck and down through her breasts, clear to her crotch, and couldn't talk, but dared to look up at last, and her brows drooped all the way down to the ends of her eyes, where the lids made a point, and the sleep hid sometimes, and shadow sighed sometimes, and love died that time. You see, I saw those shadows that time seep down through the soft skin like a dark sign. Goodbye. That's good. Thank you. Now, this is the last poem I wrote. I just finished it yesterday. It's called In My Brass Sky. This is a poem about the poet Al Zotla in the 20th century. I think I ought to say just a couple of words about this. In the 20th century, the great heroes of the 20th century are not the soldiers. They're not the knights in shining armor who go out man and slay the dragons. The great poets of the 20th century, the great heroes of the 20th century are the poets. These are the ones who fight the forces of oppression in order to free mankind, and that's the function of the hero after all. So the poet in the 20th century is blended with the hero, and the poet now is the hero of the 20th century, and upon him, upon the poet, depends the future of mankind. I honestly believe that. These are the boys, okay? This is the, you cats have been reading in the paper about all the Russians getting busted, man, in Russia. In Yugoslavia, man, they've been putting them away for 20 years. In Portugal, they bust them on a morals charge, and they send them to an island, and they keep them there until they die, and that's it. And in Spain, we know what happens in Spain. And of course, in Greece, man, you can't even put on, what's the cat, Zorba the Greek? Man, they busted that cat, you know? Okay, it's the artists, it's the poets of the society who are the true heroes, but in the 20th century, they are also outlaws. I can name 1,000 of them. Okay. In my brass sky, can't you see that man down there, wrapped in smog and an anonymous air, perched on his head like a hat? The striped tail of his shadow hangs from my trunk like a skunk. I look out windows all the time, but don't dare to lift the shade or spread the curtains, for they look for poets all over the world. And I don't have neighbors either, but every passerby has a tin ear bent to the heel step of my footprints. I'd like to jam my thumb through the metal vest of one, shove a calcium nail into a brass innard, strip the ratchet edge of a gear, scramble the pulse tick with a beep talk beam between his ears, and blow all the dead dust in his brain into steam clouds. Yes, I would. You see, I'm a poet with a star in his palm, just a little cross of two lines that signifies fame. Little lines that crisscross between two big lines caused by skin folds under the knuckles. Big lines that reach deep into the hearts of my palm toward each other, but don't touch. This star cross connects those two lines, and when curved to my ear, permits me to hear the love knock of twisted bones in another bed, or the coins tinkle in your head when you roll your eyes, even your blood sigh with your breath and mark it. I used to carry that star in his fingers up like a Sunday palm in the rain to protect me, or just to let the wet get to it and cross the fingers of my left hand. But it hurts to hold on to your star, to keep it clenched in your fist and fight with it. I'm all alone, man. I'm penned in stone on the sixth floor. In my brass sky, the pigeon's wing has a yellow glide and smokes in the skydive a stroke of sulfur past the sun-bleached pane of my tenement window. I even stand behind bars in the middle of the street, caged, you see, by my own face. That is, the cell of my skull, my brows, my bone temples, the bridge of my nose, all bar in the heavy-leaded weights of my willful eyes. Let them peek out, and don't kill my dog if I pet him too much. Can't you see how the pucker of my top lip is cleaved clear through the heart of my mouth and down to the cleft in my chin with drool, pant, pant to my breath for a kiss? Well, I'll do worse than this, I'll do worse than this as I age, strand by hair strand till only a bristle of my halo remains from the tip of one ear to the back of another, and the dregs of love's blood in my heart clot the vein in my temple with a pit-pit and burst. Yet my grandfather was a chef of his county, an atheist, and owned 600 acres of homesteaded land 100 years ago. He was a brawny mother with much flint in his knuckle grip, the kind of guy who gave his coat of arms with his hand clasp, and it was sure as prayer. You see, sweat had made a halo out of his hatband. But when I try to pray, and though I flatten my palms against each other, clear from the moons of my nails down to my lifeline, even cross my thumbs, and strain so hard sometimes I'd swear my soul creaked way inside like a swollen bladder. My chest still sounds like cop's boots caught in an alley, and my words still drop straight down like pigeon shit to the sill. But I can hear the crack of beaded knuckles carry clear to here from my dead mother's coffin, though no sun shines on my brow like some Christ's with disciples of stars in the suck of its halo. And I still mouth the moan that echoes in the hollows of her husked bones. And I can hear the wind hymn, but I can also see into the caged chests all around me, and there's not a single dove in them. No, not even the fluff left over from a feather. No, not even a bird with a spur. Just a few stray sparrows who can never believe in a clay star. My mouth is a scar. Thank you. This is the last one-page poem, and it's called Heart Song. And I first wrote this poem when I, it was the first poem I wrote after 4 years. And it was a new direction for me. I was tired, man. I quit writing poetry around 5 years ago or 6 years ago because I was tired of all the bullshit, man. You know, like all the, you know, the major poets of our day, man. And I can name a few, but I won't, you know, not cats like Rich, because they're where it's at. But the, you know, like the major poets of the campuses and that, they write old-fashioned poetry. And they're called great poets. And it's true that they touch the spirit at times. But they write old-fashioned scenes, man. And they use words, man, that were used, man, you know, for 20,000,000 years. And so I want to get someplace where that's new. I want to get someplace that speaks for me. And so this poem, so, man, you know, I have to use the language that I use, and that's man, you know. And so, and you see, and you know, and stuff like that. Because that's the way I talk, you know. And so this poem is called Heart Song, and it's a love poem. And it's about a cat. I'll tell you the story, and I hope you don't ruin it. It's about a cat who gets done in by his chick sex. May this lament pierce your earlobe, dangle, miniature, blood rings from it, while I sing of how she hung my balls from her heart pocket like love-knotted watch fobs without hands, how they swung to her pendulum step, ticked to her pulse beat, spun like a winding stem, dripped sweat beads like sand grains in her hourglass grip, how those stone globes softened to gelled sockets in her eyes. But I've also got to sing of the puffed tent of her nipple, the nudge of her spooning hip, the catch of her crooked heels in the bends of my knees, the lock of her toes on my shin bone, the cup of our groins, the suck of her velvet snatch, the clap, clap, clap of loins, and the ring, ringing of my balls. And I even have to sing, I have to sing of how she trapped my hands and crooked her wrists and spread her arms like a crucifix, then nailed me with a tongued spike through my split lips to her cross of bone and breast, belly and pinch of navel, and I came with a shiver and collapsed. Thank you very much.